Morning. So this morning I'm going to talk about money and wealth. So historically, Buddhist meditators didn't have to pay much attention to money and wealth, because going back to the beginning, and in India, and then in China and Japan, the meditators were priests or monks, and the lay people gave stuff to them. So they begged, that was part of the tradition, and lay people gave stuff to them. But what we're doing here in the U.S. is a little bit different. We all have jobs, or at least most of us, and money and wealth is a big deal for us. So how do we deal with it? So three pieces of research, really quick. First, research on couples. Two major issues in couples' relationships are money and sex. And if you haven't been in a relationship with a partner, you'll find that out. Second piece of research is that as long as we have enough money to ensure our basic needs, there's no relationship between money and happiness. There's none. Zero. So even though we have a more is better ethos here in this country and throughout most of the world, I have a Chinese friend, and he said in his country, when you're with someone, one of the first questions you ask them is how much money they make. So that's where China is right now. With the more is better ethos, right? The Taoists. What happened to the Taoists? More is better. More is better. And in the U.S., many of us feel an ingrained sense of scarcity. Only so much prosperity. The more you get, the less there is for me. So this more is better ethos in our culture is not a Buddhist ethos, not a Zen ethos. So, but it's a core value in this culture. And we know this. We know this because we know that we're always, that the culture encourages us to calculate how many megabytes we've got on our computer, what size house we're able to buy, how many email, Facebook type gadgets we can have. And The Week magazine, which I read every week, I don't know how many of you read it, but I read it, the last two pages are on houses. And they're mega houses. I don't know what has to do with the Week, but they're mega houses. I actually turned to that page first too. Now what's going on? These are houses that cost $1 to $20 million, and everybody's focused on that. And teardowns and mega mansions all over the place, all over the country, when anybody can afford it. It's a core value in our culture. Guy named third piece of research, says that. Too much money, this is from Amit Kumar at Cornell. Too much money. Too much of anything lessens our capacity for happiness, especially too much money. And he says, this may be because when we think we're well off, a sense of complacency settles in, making everything seem a bit dull. But we know from our experience, I think, most of us do, the most powerful contributor to our happiness, to our real happiness, isn't money, but the quality of our relationships. And this is really what we talk about when we talk about connecting with people and opening heart, mind. People with depression, We know this. Lots of people have suffered from depression, and one of the best antidotes to depression is reaching out. Reaching out, making a heart connection with someone. And of course, you don't feel like it when you're depressed, but it's the healthiest thing to do. Heart connections. Hard to sustain serious and persistent depression if you're really making the heart connection. Of course, you don't feel like it. You feel exhausted, but if you do it, yeah. So the quality of our relationships. So there have been a few experiments. There have been a lot of experiments, actually, in moneyless societies. Not very many of them have lasted very long, and not very many of them have had long-term impact on our society. So here's an experiment in China. Buddhist China, based on the principle that every being is of infinite worth. That's basic core teaching in Buddhism. Every being is of infinite worth, just as we are. Animate, inanimate, human, non-human. So in the 5th century in China, they had they developed monasteries where everyone in the monastery was considered of equal worth and treated accordingly. Everything was shared equally. Hierarchy existed, but it was secondary to the ideal of interdependence, equality, and generosity. And it lasted till the 7th century. That was pretty good. It lasted 200 years. Then it fizzled out. And we have more recent experiments, lots of them. State-run systems, small collectives. Kibbutzes, 1948, Israel. Communal settlements, some of which are still going, but they're just small pockets in the world. Just small pockets. Some few Scandinavian communes. And then, of course, my origins, the Sikh counterculture. Wow. Wow. That was pretty cool for a while. Pretty cool. From 72 to 75, my wife and I and our children, we lived communally with another couple and their kids. It lasted 3 years. 3 years before we couldn't stand each other. Had to all move out and go different directions. So T.S. Eliot says, between the idea and the reality falls the shadow. That's the deal. We have this idea. We'll share the wealth. We'll live together. But we're hardwired. You can practice Buddhism as long as you want. At 1,000 hours a year for 80 years, you're still hardwired. You're still culturally and genetically conditioned to take care of yourself and your family first. It's just part of the deal. It's just part of the deal of being alive. And a way of life that ignores that is doomed. It's doomed because real life is happening on the ground and in the body. Not in our ideals. In our body. Including the amygdala. Which has a very important function. So the idea of sharing is wonderful. But there's a natural impulse to put the well-being of ourselves and our loved ones first. And it's a basic Darwinian but truism. And most communal societies, including communism, ignored or repressed this. And so what happened? Passive aggressiveness, hidden agendas, shame, guilt, and then violence. So this is all interesting. It's not bad or good. It's just the more we know what our psyche is like and just be with it and accept it, the more generous we can be to ourselves and others. So it's not a condemnation or criticism. It's just what is. Just what is. So I've hung out a lot of my adult life. Well, not a lot of my adult life. I don't want to exaggerate it. But some of my adult life, both with Ojibwe people and Lakota people. And I spent time, quite a bit of time, on Rosebud Indian Reservation, Rosebud in South Dakota. And instead of Goshoing, it's Metakiasin. All my relatives, they don't gosho, but before each meal they say, all my relatives. After each meal, all my relatives. Before each ceremony, before each vision quest, all my relatives, all my relatives. So that's based on the sense of inherent connectedness of all life. Sounds not that different than Buddhism, right? Not that different. Not different at all. Not different at all. Inherent connectedness and inherent worth of everything, just as he is, just as she is, just as we are. Not after we do such and such, but now. Inherent connectedness. And that's wonderful. We have these similar dictates, the similar premises in Buddhism. Infinite mercy, worth means we all have equal value. Whether we can do Zazen well or not, whether we show up here or not. And so once I was at Elmer's house. Elmer was my Lakota teacher, and he came into the house. He'd been out at the neighbor's, and his wife said to him, and he was a teetotaler. He'd been an alcoholic, but ever since he had his vision, his first vision, he became a teetotaler. And his wife said to him, "You smell like a brewery." And then he told us this story, which is in my second book. I'm actually plagiarizing from my second book in my talk today. I'm looking at Wanda when I say that, because I have a chapter on money. She said, "You smell like brewery." And Elmer said, "Well, I was over at Joe's house. There was a bunch of people there, and all of a sudden there was explosion." And he said, "There was explosion, and beer went all over everywhere. It got all over me." And so I said, "Well, that's good. I didn't think you'd, you know, fallen off the wagon." It got all over me. And she said, "Well, what happened?" He said, "Well, somebody gave Joe a case of beer, and all his friends were coming over, and so he thought the best thing to do was hide the beer in the oven, because he knew he'd have to give a can to everybody. That's part of all my relatives. Everybody's my relative. That's give a can to everybody." And then his wife came in and turned on the oven. Metakiasin, all my relatives. So we all have basic needs, ego needs, and it's wonderful to do gosho. We need to do gosho. We need to do all my relatives. We need that stuff to remind us, but we need to take care of our basic ego needs. The more we cling to these ideals that we have, we ignore or deny our shadow, and it gets darker. We get more split off from it. So in the last 100 years, there have been two basic economies that have battled for predominance in the world, right? Marxism or communism and capitalism. And there was a time before I was born, I think, or maybe when I was tiny, when it was okay to be a Marxist. It was okay. Actually, my mother knew quite a few people who were Marxists. But then, because of the disdain for totalitarian communism, people got soured on Marxism, and it became not okay. And the House of Un-American Activities went after anyone who had any association with Marxists and tried to ruin their careers. But Marx had some cool things going for him. Well, one thing he said, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. Oh, that sounds like Buddhism. That sounds like Matakyasana, doesn't it? From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. That's wonderful, isn't it? Wonderful. It's our core value, those of us who practice here. It's our core value. But you know, the problem with that core value is it doesn't include another core value. By itself, it's not enough. It doesn't include the core value of the infinite worth of everything, of everyone, just as they are, and the principle of interdependence of all life. It's purely materialistic, which is fine, but it focuses only on the equal production and distribution of material goods. That's all it focuses on. And it says that violence may be necessary, to accomplish these goals. But we, as Zen practitioners, we don't differentiate between the means and the end. So if the means is violent, the end is going to be violent. I mean, it's just a truism for us. The means and the ends are not true. And my teachers taught that we can open our heart minds. And this is what I'm trying to pass on to you. We can open our heart minds so we take care of each other naturally without creating artificial boundaries between the means and the ends, the physical and the spiritual, the collective and the individual. What's good for the individual is good for the collective, and vice versa. So I started practicing Zen in 1964, before most of you were born, but not all of you. Most of you. 1964. It was Buddhist meditation in San Francisco with about a third of the number of people who are here today, sitting together on Sunday while my teacher was talking in San Francisco. And we thought, is this going to catch on in a capitalist democracy? Is this going to catch on? It's died out in China. Pretty much it died out in Japan, except for the forms. That's why our teachers came here. Is it going to catch on here? Well, 2 weeks ago, I just happened to pass by Barnes & Noble's, and I saw the cover of Time, and it said, Mindfulness. That was the cover of Time magazine. Mindfulness, nothing else. A couple weeks before, I was reading my favorite New Yorker columnist, whose name I forgot. He's my favorite, but I can't remember his name. And it was all about Buddhism, and he talked about his own praxis. My goodness. So it's caught on, huh? It's catching on. Wow. Wow. So I think it's partly catching on because there's a similarity in two core values. The first core value is on our coins. E pluribus unum. I don't know, I didn't do Latin, so maybe it's unum. What is it? How do you pronounce it, Steve? Unum. Okay, e pluribus unum. Out of many, one. Out of many, one. So that's one of our core values in this country. And that's the melting pot core value. Not very different than the Buddhist core value, which is the mosaic, maybe a little bit different, but the mosaic. Different colors and textures. Each piece is appreciated as it is. Each person is appreciated as she is. Complemented rather than diminished by the others around it, the other beings around it. Delicate and complex balance, but not hard to do if we do our meditation practice and still our minds. Independent and interdependent. Individual and undivided. Wow. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. That's the first core value that's similar. The second is American rugged individualism. rugged individualism. Look at Bodhidharma. If you want to know about, study a rugged individualist. He left his country, he left his people, he went to a foreign land, he sat in a cave for 9 years. Rugged individualism, right? That's a core value in our country too, right? Jiriki in Japanese Buddhism. Jiriki, self-power. We are the self-power school, the rugged individual school of Buddhism. We do this rugged individual sitting to still the heart, to still the mind and open the heart, to still the mind and open the heart. And it takes 9 years. It takes 9 years or 9 minutes. I don't want you to get discouraged. So it takes 9 minutes. But it takes 9 minutes and then 9 minutes and then 9 minutes ad infinitum. Till you're... I'm 74, or whenever I die. So Jiriki, self-power. Which opens us to interdependence. One nation, individual, with liberty and justice for all. Anybody ever heard that anywhere? One nation, individual, not divided, but liberty and justice for each person, each entity. Core value, right? The under God was added when I was 11 years old. But I said that Pledge of Allegiance for my first years without the under God. Then I thought, why did they add the under God? They just messed it up. Even then, I was a Buddhist and I didn't know it. Under God's fine, under Buddha, whatever. Whatever. So in this country, there are three rails of making money. Three rails. The for-profit sector, the public sector, and the not-for-profit sector. And the not-for-profit sector, the non-profit sector, Minnesota Zen Center is a non-profit organization. It's flourishing more than in all the other European countries combined. It's really flourishing here. It's really flourishing. And it's based on interdependence through reciprocity. Whether you work for a nonprofit or you contribute to a nonprofit, there's the ideal of helping others. And that's how the nonprofit sector is sustained. Well, what about the for-profit sector, which is predominant? Well, the for-profit sector also really is based on reciprocity. You sell a product, you provide a service, but there's a tension. In the for-profit sector, between the primary profit motive and the core value of infinite worth. There's a tension there, right? And the best companies, the best for-profit businesses, have leaders who provide high-quality products and services, trusting that the profit will follow. Well, Wall Street doesn't like that too well, but they go ahead and do it. They go ahead and do it. And I'm going to talk briefly about one of those guys, a guy named Bill Hewlett. Hewlett Packard. So I grew up in Palo Alto, California, which is where Silicon Valley started, although it didn't start till after I left. And there was in my town... there was a guy named Bill Hewlett who went to college with my dad and was doing this thing in his garage that my dad said was crazy. He said, this guy is crazy. He and Bill Hewlett and David Packard He said, I don't know what they're up to. He said, they've gotten a lot of loans, and they don't have any money, and they've hired all these really good people, and they let them go on vacation whenever they want, and they just treat them well. And they don't worry about profit at all. He said, this is going to fail. That's the beginning of Silicon Valley, you guys. And you could read about Bill Hewlett, but he was a wonderful person, whose core value was providing technology to people in a way that would enhance their interconnectedness, enhance their communication. And he hired a bunch of people who had the same core value, and he treated them like equals. And the companies thrived, and Silicon Valley grew out of that, and there was something that was called the HP way, the Hewlett-Packard way, which died about, I lose track, 25 years ago. Bill died, and Hewlett-Packard became just like the rest of corporate America. That Wall Street became the master. Wall Street became the master. Once Wall Street is the master, it's very hard to keep these core values alive. So when my dad was getting old, he had a caretaker that we got for him named Marlene, who came in the days and worked for him, and my dad was kind of cranky, kind of cantankerous. And Marlene said to me one day, I'm tired of working for your dad. And I didn't know what to say. I needed Marlene. I was here in Minnesota. So, but anyway, I said, oh, gee, so I said, you must have had better experiences with other people. And she said, yes, I'm really sad that Bill Hewlett died. She said, when I worked for him, he always asked when I came in if I'd had my lunch. He couldn't even get out of bed. And when I came in and I had a noon shift, he asked me how I was going to fix my lunch and if there was a way he could help me fix my lunch. Well, he couldn't even get out of bed. But she said that's what he cared about. He always had ideas about how he could support me. So that's that's beautiful story, huh? So he's a Buddhist and didn't even know it. You don't have to be a Buddhist. You don't have to say, I'm a Buddhist. He believed in the sense of connectedness. He opened his heart. And the mission of his small company, Hewlett-Packard, was based on that belief. So the Bill Hewletts and the Katagiris and the Suzukis teach us how to remain fluid, how to remain generous, how to remain engaged in a capitalist society. This is undoubtedly a very capitalist society, more so now than ever, fortunately or unfortunately. How to manifest the interdependent nature and infinite worthiness of everything and everyone. Everything and everyone. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful that we have that opportunity to do that? And this means that there's not so much difference in our culture, in our Zen culture, between work and play. Between work and play. Because if the ends and the mean are separated, we're always trying to go somewhere else and get the money and get the this, so we're not really engaged with the labor. So a story about Katagiri Roshi, the founding teacher here. So once on a Friday night, we had a meeting here. Now, why we had a meeting on a Friday night, I don't know, but we had meetings all the time. Including 4:30 in the morning. Those are practice period meetings, but I don't want to get into that right now. So we had a meeting on a Friday night, and people were late coming to the meeting. Ojasan looked at me and he said, "I know, where are they?" And I said, "I don't know. Maybe they're at a TGIF party." He said, "TGIF? What that?" "What that?" I said, "That's thank God it's Friday." "Thank God it's Friday? What that?" And I explained the whole thing to him. He really had trouble getting it. He really had trouble getting it. Our teachers taught us to engage with our work so that it gives us life, and so we can give life to others. And then what's the difference between work and play? We do it wholeheartedly. We give and we get back. We give and we get back. We give and we get back. Intrinsic worth of each activity. Each activity. So somebody asked Buddha, "What should I do with my land?" Buddha replied, "Don't let your property sit idle. Plant crops on your land." So we use what we have to add vitality. We might not have much, but we have something. When we're generous, we feel wealthy. You guys know this. When you're generous, you feel wealthy. A hoarder experiences scarcity, driven to hoard more and more, always having the feeling of not enough, not enough. So once I was walking to the Zen Center in San Francisco, and I passed my teacher on the sidewalk with a big bag, looked like a grocery bag. And I said, "Oh," you know, I don't know what I said, "hi" or something. And I said, "Oh, you know, you come from the store?" And he said, "Look inside." He said, "Only 2 days old." And he opened the bag, and there was tomatoes in there, and lettuce, and potatoes. And I looked inside. First, it looked pretty good, but then he said, "Only 2 days old." I went, "Look." Although I tried not to restrain myself in front of him. "Only 2 days old," he said. Then he invited me to soup for soup, and I turned him down. Because of my prejudice, right? I turned him down. So, I don't know, was he doing dumpster diving? I still don't know. I can't imagine him dumpster diving. Somewhere he'd gotten two-day-old vegetables and he was really excited about it. He was going home to make some soup. But those guys, Katagiri and Suzuki, came from cultures of real scarcity. Katagiri used to talk about having nothing to make their soup with in the monastery, so they went out and gathered weeds and made weed soup, and how good the weed soup tasted. So, scarcity is relative. It's relative. Suzuki Roshi said, "Money is not yours, it belongs to society." So life is a continual engagement and an exchange with mutual respectfulness, as much as possible, with mutual respectfulness. Bill Hewlett could give, and he could give without a lot of thought after he had been successful about where he was going or what he could get back. But actually, he started out giving in the first place in that garage. And then the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation developed. You ever listen to NPR? They've been sponsoring different programs on NPR and NPR for decades. So my teacher said, my first teacher said, Suzuki Roshi said, "Work on things with respect. That should be the true nature of labor." Work on things with respect. That should be the true nature of labor. So if we labor with respect for the work being done, value is added. It's just value added right there. And if you get paid for it, that's cool. But the value is already there. If we have respect for the work being done and for the labor of others, value is added. And when we do that, we feel an abundance in our heart. Whether we have an abundance in our bank account is a different issue, but if we feel an abundance in our heart, our bank account is secondary. Of course we need to take care of it, but it's secondary. Inner wealth fills us up. No sense of scarcity or of lacking. Outer wealth can't compare to the joy of inner wealth. What Dogen calls one bright pearl. What other teachers call the Buddha nature. No scarcity in here. No scarcity in here. We're okay wherever we are. One bright pearl, the Buddha nature. And then we can take delight in the color of the sky, the shape of a cloud, the patterns formed by the leaves that are falling. And we can respond compassionately to the pain in the eyes of a suffering child. One of my grandsons can't seem to learn how to read. And for him, it's the social embarrassment of it. I mean, we're encouraging, we're pretending, we're not saying anything, but he is in school, and he's behind the other kids. So my heart goes out to him. But my heart goes out to any grandchild or any child who's feeling embarrassed or ashamed because they're having a difficult time. That's natural. That comes from my Buddha nature, doesn't it? Comes from one bright pearl, right in here. Wow. What inner wealth we have. What inner wealth we have. The pain in the eyes of a homeless person. Yes, we want to avert our eyes. But if we really look, we see that pain. We feel that pain. And we're compassionate. We're compassionate. So I think that's what I want to say this morning. And I'll be glad to entertain questions or comments. Or I can elaborate on anything. Steve.
Since the time we call it satellite, we go for these Thursday meeting, our groups, our teams would meet on different mornings of the week. And then we'd see videos, and they keep on adding, more burdens on the techs.
Birds on the whom?
On the techs that would install the satellite.
Oh.
So, the techs, it was this game. They'd add more burdens, and you'd figure out what you had, the minimum that you had to do to install the satellite so it would work and you can get paid. But they said one of the videos they showed us, they had some grass hat. Don't think of it as working on a church. So it was exploitation because it was like, I don't know how stupid we thought we were as techs, but our satellite installers, but. It's like we were supposed to think of it as a church. But in fact, they were just all these burdens on you, and you had to, you really had to play against them and against the homeowner to make a few bucks. So it wasn't like you could enjoy the work.
Mm-hmm.
You could mm-hmm. respect the mm-hmm. work. You had to respect yourself, mm-hmm. including your spine. I mean, you're humping these heavy ladders, satellites up and down the ladder. So I think a lot of work was just like that. And that's the alienation that shows up.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I'm sure we could all give examples of that. What else? Bernie.
If you'll indulge me, two things occurred to me while you were talking. One was when you talk about needing to care for our own basic needs, was Reinhold Niebuhr's concept that the will to survive is very easily corrupted into the will to power.
The will to survive is very easily corrupted into the will to power.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very, very difficult time finding that line, that line of enough.
Yeah.
We observe that very closely about Western society. Never enough.
Yeah.
And you being a trained psychologist, the other, and mentioning Wall Street being in charge, the thing that always occurs to me about Wall Street is the psychological concept of compartmentalization, where we set outside this sort of section of our activities, this section of our selves, the way a sociopath might.
Mm-hmm.
Complete lack of empathy.
Yes.
And it seems to me like Wall Street as a sort of concept, not the place, is our social setting aside of our own greed. This is the place in life where I will be greedy.
Yes, compartmental. Could you guys hear him? Could you hear him back there? Yes, compartmentalization and fragmentation. Compartmentalization and fragmentation. And we can see how we do this in our minds. But through our sitting practice, we have a chance to see that over-compartmentalization causes a kind of fragmentation that just causes suffering for everybody. Everybody. Lawrence.
I think some of the compartmentalization of Wall Street, too, it's not even in their own self-interest. It's all, like, a lot of it is sort of short-term oriented. You know,
uh-huh.
Sort of looking at
that's right. That's right. Right. So how did the market do today? How did it do today?
Even NPR can't stop themselves from...
Pardon?
Even NPR can't stop themselves from...
Right.
Dow every day.
Yeah, right.
Finance people think that's completely dumb.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, you made the mention of three groups, and the one was non-profit, and it kind of indicates that non-profit is maybe all good, but actually, in actuality... there are non-profit companies out there, but some of the CEOs or the people working for them make horrendous salaries, and you kind of torn between are they really a total non-profit or charitable organization?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Could you guys hear him? That was in my talk, but I cut my talk down because I, out of respect for you. I know my talks are too long, so I'm trying to be more respectful. Yes, he's exactly right. He's exactly right. And you know, whether it's a non-profit CEO can get just as enamored of his own power as a for-profit, and just as in feeling just as scarce, you know. I mean, you know, I was a CEO, and those monthly financials come out. When are the monthly financials going to come out? Do I get to see them tomorrow? What will my board think? How are the P&Ls? How are the profit? Tim, remember you have this inner wealth. It's right here. What's happening? What's happening? It's right here. One right furl, Tim. One right furl. Now that was 5 minutes I cut out of my talk. What else?
Yeah,
Larry.
That can happen to, like you say, nonprofits, public organizations, spiritual organizations still can become like that.
That's right. Spiritual organizations can become like that.
Be more oriented toward the organization rather than the individual.
Can you speak a little louder, Larry?
More oriented toward the organization rather than individual.
No, that's right. Anybody else? Yeah, Mark.
Yeah, I just wanted to there are two words, alienation and compartmentalization, and those are two key drafts to keep Marx out of capitalism. And I think our practice really addresses those in a very poignant.
Alienation and what else?
Compartmentalization.
Compartmentalization, uh-huh.
And people feel alienated from their work and their lives because of this hyper-compartmentalization. But our practice really addresses that in really poignant and important ways. And I think our practice offers a profound antidote to a lot of the Marx critiques of capitalism through our practice of intimacy. And I know you talk a lot about intimacy, but maybe you could talk a little bit more about intimacy through the lens of daily work.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. Did you ask me to speak?
Pardon? Oh, go ahead. Oh. Go ahead.
No, I don't want to interrupt.
Oh, I see. Oh, to comment on what Mark said. Oh, well, I just agree with Mark.
Can you repeat it, Tim, what Mark said?
Oh, Mark, can you say it a little louder?
Well, I would just commenting that Mark's most poignant critiques of capitalism had to do with two comments I heard of compartmentalization and alienation from our lives and our work, and I think Zen is a direct antidote to both those through Dazen and the practice of intimacy. And you talked so eloquently about intimacy all the time, and I thought maybe if you wanted to say a few more words about intimacy, interconnection, and our work.
So I don't know what I have to say about that except that I agree with Mark. Our practice is about intimacy. How can we be respectful of how can I be respectful of this little folder that I brought from home if I don't have some feeling of connection with it? And if I'm thinking a lot, it's hard for me to feel intimate. If my thinking is more austere, well, I have to think some. It's good to think. I mean, I had to do a lot of thinking for this talk or for this book, right? But intimacy means there's no wall between the subject and the object. There's just this sense of connectedness, intimacy. And when there is that, there's no alienation. And if you start feeling alienated, it means that you've lost that. And Zazen can help. But Zazen is not a cure. But sitting still and working with a teacher and working with a community can help so that you can feel intimacy with everything and everyone. And then there is no alienation. Then there's no compartmentalization. We're not caught by our thinking mind. Our thinking mind doesn't create a wall anymore between the subject and the object. How's that? Pamela.
So do you think that with this connection of intimacy that compassion naturally arises, or how does
compassion... If compassion doesn't naturally arise, it's not intimate. It's just not intimate if compassion doesn't arise. Because intimacy is about the heart. It's about the heart. And if there's a feeling of connection, my connection of my heart to whatever's going on with you, then I'm going to be compassionate toward you. Just am. Anything more?
Tim?
Yeah.
Something separate.
Sure, Jason.
In response to an anecdote to kind of sit with related to compartmentalization, I don't know if anybody's ever taking the opportunity to experience caucusing.
Experience what?
Caucusing. Caucusing at the...
Oh, caucusing.
Caucusing.
Can you hear?
The caucus process in...
Yeah.
Local elections leading up to choose a candidate. But as part of an election, a group of community members in a district or precinct get to gather in a room and state what these ground level values are that they want as part of the platform.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so, you know, a bunch of gung-ho people in this room saying, well, talking about white supremacy and how to, like, ways to affect racism, talking about recycling. So, like,
yeah.
Some
yeah.
ground level, like,
yeah.
some very liberal
yeah.
Proposals. And then someone said, and I think one of the people leading the workshop, or leading the session was a teacher. And she kind of had these responses every now and then to, like, yes, you could tell she was behind it, and who's, let's vote on this. And then someone said, and public institutions should fully divest from oil corporations.
Uh-huh.
And there was this pause. Like, well, what's that going to do to my 401b or my 401k?
Uh-huh.
You know, striking, like, mirror put up to,
yeah.
like, oh, that's...
yeah.
That is going to affect me.
That's right.
Maybe I can support.
Yeah, that's right.
Companies and compartmentalize
yeah.
my money in Wall Street.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Thanks. That's a good example. It's a good example. Okay, I think that's enough. Thank you all, and turn it over to Jim.